Yes.
Thanks.
Okay. Great. So for everyone who saw me on the plane this morning, desperately making these slides, it was all an act. I had these slides done months ago, so I fooled everyone. So the name of my talk is From Our Fat Camp. I want to talk about defensive techniques that I've been working on at Columbia University. That's part of my PhD thesis work for retrofitting embedded devices, removing vulnerabilities from them automatically, and fortifying their code to make exploitation of those devices more difficult. But we're not really going to do that, not yet. I want to talk about something more fun. I want to talk about Fontana. And you can see this is my super awesome, very professionally made antenna here that we brought for you guys. And this is really to finish up a presentation that I did last year. I came here and I talked about the Cisco phone exploitation that we did. And at the end of the day, we figured out ways to exploit the kernel of this phone and pull microphone data from the handset mic over there, right? And the way we did that was by reconfiguring. We had to hack a physical switch. Now, this sounds like a difficult thing. It shouldn't be possible. But it was, and the reason why it was because that switch was connected to a GPIO pin, a general input, general purpose input and output pin, which we reconfigured from input to output to fool the software into thinking that the handset was picked up when it really wasn't. So that worked, and when we did that, we looked at the pin now, and all of a sudden it occurred to us that if we can reconfigure this pin and have it turn up high and low and high and low, if we can do that fast enough, we probably would be able to make an antenna, a transmitter out of it to exfiltrate arbitrary data from this phone at, you know, pretty low frequency probably, but still something that you can pick up using something like an Edis Research, like USRP, SDR, or really like an AM radio hooked up to, you know, your audio, your sound card. So we looked at it, it seemed reasonable, and we went home and we didn't really do anything about it, and it bugged me for a long time. And I really had to mythbuster this thing out to really see if this type of attack, this type of technique would work at all. And we did that, and here is the result that I'd like to show you guys. So first, what is the definition of Fontana? Fontana is a software payload that intentionally causes the host hardware, right, to act as an improvised RF transmitter using existing hardware, which are typically not used, typically not designed for RF emanation, right? In sort of signal intelligence parlance, this is more like a piece of software that intentionally causes compromising emanation. So if we're talking about intentionally causing emanation, let's talk about unintentional compromising emanation. There's a lot of work, a lot of prior art in this area. Most of it is classified awesome sauce. Not a lot of it is unclassified, so there's not a lot of detail, but some things have slipped out, and I want to tell a story about, this is a story that Peter Wright told. He was a MI5 counterintelligence officer who wrote a book about his life and work called Spycatcher. So this story takes place in 1960, okay? This is an embassy, you can tell because the table is embassy-like, right? And on this embassy is a telex, a teletype device, right? I had to, oh, and this is a French embassy, so there's that. I had to Google what a teletype looked like. This is my rendition of what it probably didn't look like. But because this is inside an embassy, this is not a typical teletype. This is a super secret crypto teletype, right? In the way, oh, and it also has a cable back to the mothership, right? Probably to somebody in France. So that this is the way it works. You type in clear text, okay? And this machine encrypted the clear text and sent out ciphertext. And that's good, but it turns out ciphertext is really hard to read, and the British intelligence people wanted to read what was going on inside the French embassy. And they couldn't really figure out an easy way to crack the encryption, so they turned to something else. They noticed that if you watch the output of this cable, right, along with the ciphertext, there was what they called an electronic echo of the clear text, right, along with the signal. And this happened because the device wasn't properly shielded, so every time you press the button on the device, there's enough EM emanation that would trickle down to the wire that would tell the observer which key was pressed on the thing along with the ciphertext that was being transmitted. So this is a really good example of unintentional compromising emanation. Like I said, most of this stuff is classified, but some of this work has been made out into the public. For example, Van Eyck freaking, right? This was paper that was published in the 60s, I guess, 80s, that basically said that you can reconstruct the output of CRT displays by looking at the RF emanation of that device in real time, right? So you can listen with a radio and reconstruct the words that are being printed on CRTs. And this makes sense because, you know, CRT is a big electron gun that's scanning around. It's putting out a lot of power. And years later, Marcus Kuhn wrote a paper that said, well, this not only works on CRTs, this also works on LCDs, right? The DVI connector was actually something that was emanating enough RF power that you can actually reconstruct what was being said or what was being displayed on an LCD as well. And displays are not the only things you can read from using a radio. You can actually observe the output of RS-232 communication, a serial cable from something like 10 feet away, by receiving the signal that it put out, right, over basically FM range. So this is another paper somebody did, I think, maybe 15, 20 years ago. And compromising emanation doesn't only have to live in RF range, right? They can live in acoustic range. So this is a very recent paper that talked about extraction of RSA keys, right, through acoustic leak of the hardware, right? So that's a really cool paper. You guys should check it out. So knowing that you can capture and analyze unintentional emanation, right, it should make sense that we should be able to construct a piece of software to cause this type of emanation and choose the text or choose the data that we can transmit out of the device. So we wanted to build a proof of concept. And this proof of concept, we wanted to have it be on open hardware and open software so the community can take a look at it, can play with it, improvise, improve on it. We also wanted to use hardware, or specifically embedded device hardware, that is ubiquitous with capabilities that are found and on as many embedded devices as possible, right? So we eventually settled on this. We used the BeagleBone and a GPIO pin and a wire, right? So GPIO is something that you can find on all sorts of embedded devices. The BeagleBone runs ARM. It's not really important which architecture the CPU runs, but this is something that if we can get the Fontana to work on this reference design, we would have some confidence that would say that this type of attack, this type of technique, will work on a lot of different devices that are in the world today. Okay, so this is our montage of science learning. Okay, I said, well, how do we do this? I want to do this in software. I want to make a radio. So let's figure out how to write a simple software-defined radio, right? We got some books on that, and you know, it was really complicated and took a long time, right? And then we asked ourselves, like, well, how do radios work? That was really complicated too. And then we're like, how do electrons, like, what do they do, right? And eventually, we came up with what we thought we needed for an SDR. And you know, this is sort of a reference design for like your typical stand-up software-defined radio transmitter architecture. So you start with a DSP, and then you have something that converts digital to analog, right? And then you filter that through a low-pass filter. You combine that with a local variable oscillator of some sort. You pump it through a bandpass filter, and then you power amplify it, and you then put it on a transmitting element, and then you have your SDR transmitter. But we don't really have that, right? We have a board and a wire. So do we have a DAC? No, we have a wire, right? Do we have a low-pass filter? No, we have a wire, right? Do we have an oscillator? We do, we actually do. We can control the pin high and lowness, right? So we kind of have that, sort of maybe. Do we have a power amp? Nope, we have a wire, right? Do we have a bandpass filter? No, wire. Do we have an antenna? Yes, right? We have a wire, like this will work. So here's the idea, right? This is the reference Fontana implementation idea. You have a system on a chip, right, which is hooked to either a input pin, which is hooked to a button of some sort, which is not grounded, right? And or you have an output pin that's meant for transmission that may not be connected to ground or some other load. For example, the UART pin sitting on devices, right? And the idea is if you can flip the bits fast enough, right, in a predefined pattern, that would be enough to emanate RF power. And if you can do that, right, you can receive it from some feet or tens of feet, maybe hundreds of feet away, and then you would win. And this is what we set out to build, and I'm gonna turn it over to my colleague Zach, who's gonna talk about what we build and how it works.
Hey, so I'm Zach. I worked with Ong on the reference implementation of the Fontana, and I wanna talk, we registered the domain name fontana.org. Don't go there. because it is empty right now. We spent most of today trying to fix our demo. But we really would like this to be a very community-driven thing. We think the idea of a Funtenna is cool, and it's even cooler if there is a gigantic list of like many, many devices on which the Funtenna has been proven to work. So within a day or so, we're gonna throw all of our information up on there, details about what we tried, what worked, what didn't, what we think are possible improvements, what means we think you can use to make a Funtenna. And we want it to be an open source, community-driven effort. So we're gonna throw all the code we used and instructions so that you can try this at home. So anyway, as Ong said, for our reference implementation, we used a BeagleBone, which is currently duct taped to my laptop. And the reason we wanted to use this is it's well documented, unlike a lot of the potential Funtenna hardware out there. This does not take away from the spirit of the Funtenna. This just makes it easier to sort of flesh out a proof of concept, and then we can move on to the hard part of doing it on a real world device. And it's reasonably cheap, and it's reproducible. You can get one of these pretty easy. So as you can see, we just stuck a wire out of one of the GPIO pins, and that is our antenna. And to receive, we used a fancy schmancy USRP2 software-defined radio from Edis Research. This is really nice. And so to pair with our fancy schmancy software-defined radio hardware unit, we have this antenna, which is looking real professional. And so we found this combination worked pretty well for picking up signals. And honestly, at the frequencies we're working with, we got the BeagleBone to transmit at about 12.5 megahertz. You could probably use an AM radio receiver or something similar. You don't need anything quite as fancy as this. So in an ideal world, what's going to happen right now is I'm going to show you a demo and it's going to work swimmingly. We found this room like 40 minutes ago, and we didn't really have time to see if everything works. I'm gonna walk you through what the process of me sending a message through the Funtenna should look like. So what Ong's doing right now is pulling up a virtual machine running. GNU Radio has a nice suite of equipment for working with, or software for working with software-defined radio. It does a bunch of signal processing, and we wrote some of our own stuff to go along with that. That doesn't look good. Okay, so what you're seeing now is I am just, for calibration, transmitting a 010101 pulse from the BeagleBone. That does not look the best.
You want to restart it? I'll hold the antenna.
Okay, so we're going to use a human to hold our antenna. This might work better.
And the reason why everything is duct taped down is because we did crap job soldering all these things.
On the plane, a lot of wires jostled loose, and they were not a good fun day today. So what's happening right now is I'm just transmitting on off on off on off. Do you want me to restart this?
Yeah.
So we're gonna show you sort of around the Funtenna land. So this is a scope. The top plot is the signal that's being received by the radio. And hopefully you'll see pretty soon this nice on-off pattern, which is what we're sending out. That signal is being generated by the wire on the BeagleBone on my laptop, or that is taped to my laptop. And down here is we're trying to parse that into a 010101. And sort of the flow for this is we have the signal coming out of the USRP through a bandpass filter that captures the band or the frequency we're interested in, smooths it out with a RMS. We use gain control to hopefully be able to deal with any signal strength. We average it to smooth it out. We take a threshold to convert it into binary 0-1. This logic here is logic we wrote to sample, hopefully one sample per bit that we're broadcasting, and I'll get into the nitty-gritty of the protocols we were using. And then we Hamming coded our data for error tolerance. And then we this looks like a mess down here, but it really just packs the nibbles we get out of the Hamming code data back into bytes. And that information comes out into this file right here.
Do you want to like move
your
monitor a little bit?
Yeah, so let's see if we can't get a stronger signal here.
Is this thing running?
Yeah. Whoa.
Here, let's restart that.
Okay. Yeah, and then I'll explain a little more in detail about the BeagleBone in a flash. But as Ong said, all we're doing is turning it high, low, high, low, high, low, and as fast as we possibly can in order to get a signal. And if all goes well in a minute, I'll have a message for you. So the BeagleBone, like I said, there's documentation about it. We wrote a kernel module that just toggles on, off, on, off, on, off as fast as we possibly can. And we came up with a duration for each symbol. We used what's called on-off keying. So we either transmitted a signal for a one or didn't transmit a signal for a zero. Like Ong said, we don't really know anything about radios. And this is why we want it to be a community-driven effort. I'm sure many, many of you are much better at RF than we are. So if you can make improvements that prevent things like this from happening to make it, because the reason this is not working is due to us and not due to this. But yeah.
But it's leveling out now.
Okay.
I think this just has to do with interference in the room around this frequency, maybe.
Yeah.
Do you want to like wiggle that pin a little bit?
This one.
Oh, wait, no, it's so much better now.
I will not move.
Okay, this is the reason why we had to duct tape everything down, because he brought this, and it's totally paying off, because the wires are kind of loose, and it really matters, the connection between that wire and the board. But you can see now there's a pretty clear waveform, right? And this is the BeagleBone just flipping its pin on and off, and it's transmitting, you know, good amount of distance. And with a better antenna, like the one we have in our office, this can go much further.
All right, so.
So don't move your finger. Let's try to transmit something here, right?
Let's go for gold. No. The demo gods are not smiling on us today.
Do you want to restart this thing one more time?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Let's start. It's really cool when it works. So. But like.
Anyway, so a little more about what we're doing behind the scenes. So that on-off keying is not the best method of transmitting data, but again, the dead simplest path to a proof of concept. We've seen this work successfully. We're not just messing with you all. At a distance of up to 30 feet, and I think the signal was strong enough that we probably could have gone a little further. We were limited by the room because we are work in New York where there's zero space for activities. All right, so that looks like it's nice and stable. I'm going to try to not move my finger.
Look, it worked. Don't move, don't breathe. Wait for it. For it.
Oh no. That was ASCII art.
Yeah, well, it's still ASCII art.
Now it's Unicode art.
We need better error correction, but it's supposed to dump out ASCII art of the Chaos Rocket. We'll show you later.
Good enough.
Right. We'll put it on the website. But you can see this thing is transmitting, right?
Yeah. Okay. Cool. So you want to head back to the slides? Thanks for bearing with us. Well. Oh, that looks wrong.
Yeah, it's not.
So anyways, we're using on-off key, and we decided we did arbitrarily that we'd use 100,000 on-off cycles per bit. Oh yeah, that, can you?
Sort of does it?
It's not changing when I do this, which is pretty critical. Nope.
All right, hold on, I could do this.
Okay. So we fixed the set signal duration per bit. We wrote our messages in a format that involved a prologue of 1100 1100, just to let us know that we're transmitting a packet. And then you encode the packet length. And then we Hamming encoded the data, which supposedly protects against errors. We used a Hamming 7.4 code, so for each nibble of information that we were transmitting, if we have one bit flip, it gets corrected. If we have two, it doesn't, and I think that's what we saw there. But sometimes this works and it's cool. So this is exactly what I was talking about with the on-off keying. We used 100,000 cycles per bit, and these are all parameters that could be toggled for improvement. And then our data comes in the Hamming code. So some of the real world issues we were struggling with that people who make nice like network cards and stuff don't have to deal with are we were doing all the bit flipping in CPU, so things were getting preempted and our symbols were of irregular duration. You can see that's 11 milliseconds, that's 12 milliseconds. This is a very scientific drawing, 7 or 9, right? And so all the bits are like slightly different lengths. So I'm sure you could design the over-the-air protocol in a way that would cope with this a little better. It stopped again.
Wait.
Did I?
Okay, keep going. Yeah. Better?
Yes. Okay. And so combined with that prior thing, we have the idea of sample drift, which is when something goes wrong, it can go really, really wrong. We try to sample in the middle of each bit, but if it's a bunch of all low values, we might sample too many times, and then from that point on, everything looks bad. And again, people who know radios, hopefully you all can deal with this stuff. But the bandwidth we got was also pretty unimpressive. We were doing 12.5 megahertz, 100,000 cycles per bit, which is about 16 bytes per second, which I think I can talk faster than that. But in theory, we should be able to do much faster. I brought it down to 1,500 cycles per bit, which would be about 8.3 kilobits per second. And as you can see on the O-scope, there's still a very clearly defined on-off pattern. There's room for other improvements. You could use something better than on-off keying. You could use frequency shift keying, so broadcast at one frequency for 1.0, broadcast at another for 0.0, another for 0.1, another for 1.1, and get more information out faster. You can make improvements to the protocol to deal with sample drift to make sure that each bit or each byte arrives intact, packets of fixed size, and so on and so forth. And you can do things in the kernel to make it so that the duration is less irregular. And as Ong's going to talk about in a couple minutes, if you do things other than GPIO, you don't run into this problem. So that's all right. That's my bit.
So we took our reference implementation and we said, okay, it works on the BeagleBone. Let's go back to the phone that we originally looked at. And this is where the Fontana meets reality and reality one here. So we thought, wouldn't it be nice if the GPIO on the phone worked this way, where all the pins go to buttons, right? And you can just reconfigure the buttons and turn them into little transmitters. It turns out you can fool the software into thinking that the pin has been pressed, right? But when you actually do that, the voltage is not actually pushed out to the pin, to the button. And here's why that happens. And this is not just this specific phone, but we looked at a few other embedded devices too that have GPIO. It turns out GPIO is generally multiplexed, right? So there are about maybe 8 pins of GPIO going to some multiplexer logic, which then goes out to all of the buttons and whatnot, which means you can actually send a current down, right, this path, but it would hit some multiplexing logic and it would actually not emanate very much RF power at all. So we lose there, and we got super bummed, but we went back to the phone and we looked at the other things that are, you know, on this board, and we started doing some creative thinking. And we noticed that there are 2 gigabit Ethernet ports here, right? So these are gigabit Ethernet cable or interfaces, and they can obviously flip bits at more or less that speed. And there's also an UART that we can maybe do something with. We went with the more direct approach, not messing with the Ethernet controller. We went directly to the UART, and we thought, well, wouldn't it be really nice if I can just flip the UART pin really fast, right, and have it be a transmitter as well. And this is when I looked at ARM Linux implementation. You can find a lot of source code in the ARM kernel, or in the Linux kernel in ARM, for how this stuff all works. And we looked at the PL011 UART, which is pretty common in the devices that I was looking at. Here's how that all works. For example, the BCM ring class of processors, system on chips, have what's called an EMBA bus. So the Advanced Microcontroller Bus Architecture, and the UART sits as a slave on that bus. And that UART has 2 pins, or more than 2, but the one that we really care about is a TXD pin. And the ARM SoC provides a reference clock to the UART, which then the UART divides to set its baud rate appropriately. And you can find the data sheet here. So that this data sheet is publicly available, and there's source code in the Unix kernel, in the Linux kernel. And it turns out you can actually overclock this clock by 4 times and get it to send data really, really fast, right? Much faster than it was supposed to. And this is the call that you have to make in the kernel, right? This is all very well documented. The UART clock is 5. Just say 5. I want you to go 4 times faster, and it'll just do it. And all you have to do then is send a string of characters to the UART, and then it would put that bit pattern onto the wire. And if you do that fast enough, then you have a transmitter. So that actually works. And I'll show you some data we have on that. This is what a 9600 baud transmission looks like under spectrum analyzer, right? You get a 4.8 kilohertz signal. It's not very impressive at all. If you set it, and this is the waveform that you get when you send the letter U, right, to the UART. If you set it to the maximum baud rate that this device supported, you would get something like a 229.5 kilohertz transmission. Still, you know, it's getting there, but it's really not that great. But if you overclock this thing 4 times, right, you get all of a sudden a 918 megahertz signal. And actually, this is, you can double that because the way Manchester encoding works. So all of a sudden, you have like a 1.8 megahertz transmitter that is just sitting on the UART of pretty much every device that you have, right? Your laptop has one, this embedded device has one, the phone has one. And you can use that device to transmit radio signal for antenna. So here it is. We sent the letter U, right, which is bit pattern 010101. But if you really wanted to send the fastest signal, right, you just send either OXFF, right, or the null character, which would go up and down very fast. So the highest speed that I was able to get this particular UART to transmit at was about 1.8 megahertz. And then we also notice that there are harmonics that goes all the way up to the 11 megahertz, 12 megahertz range as well. So that worked, and I started looking at other potential antennas and devices that I've been looking at. And here's one, you know, Travis Goodspeed's paper, right, on backdooring hard drives, right, really cool. And it turns out the hard drive controller is ARM computer with an UART on it, right, that's not connected to any cable. So all of a sudden, you can have your hard drives transmitting, you know, information out. And you can also use Ethernet interfaces, right? 4 out of the 8 pins on Cat5e, not used, not connected, right? But sometimes the cables are still run, which makes it a really nice antenna, possibly. And look at all these ports on your laptop, right? So these are all things that are capable of very high data rates. Now, if you're able to control the software that makes, you know, bit patterns come out of these pins, you can potentially use these things as antennas too. So there are all sorts of possibilities in the devices that we have around us. And we hope that with the code that we put up, the community will go out and find more antennas and such. Okay, so no more procrastinating. Like, now I have to talk about my PhD research, I guess. It's just called From Our Fat Camp. I'll more or less make it fast. It's really not called that. It's, you know, in academic speak, it's called autotomic binary structure randomization. And this is a collection of 2 different techniques that are designed to improve the security of existing embedded devices without requiring hardware modification or access to source code. I'm going to talk about autotomy first and then binary structured randomization. So autotomy is essentially the idea that your embedded device has a whole bunch of features inside that you don't want, you didn't configure, that you don't really need, and it should never execute. So if that's really the case, so for example, this is a Cisco router, you don't really need MGCP, VRRP, HSRP, every other P, EIGRP, HTTP, SIP, Skinny, DHCP server, maybe, maybe not. You might as well just take it out of the firmware, right? If you could do that, the code is gone. It can never be re-enabled by an attacker. It cannot be reused by the attacker to do malicious things. And one good example of that is Lawful Intercept, which I think FX has a really good talk on, right? So I'm gonna, that's gonna be very interesting because a lot of these routers who don't necessarily need to run Lawful Intercept actually has the code to do Lawful Intercept in them. And if you're not familiar with what Lawful Intercept is exactly what it sounds like it is, right? Lawful Intercept. So if you don't have to run Lawful Intercept code, you might as well just take it out of the router. And I'm gonna show you ways, an algorithm, a generalized algorithm to do this automatically. Right, if it's not configured, take it out of the firmware. Now, once you have taken the unnecessary firmware out of, or unnecessary code out of the firmware, you end up with, you know, a piece of firmware with a whole bunch of spots in it, right? Empty spaces that you can now all of a sudden use for whatever you want to use. And what if you started moving actual code around into those empty spaces, like an 8-puzzle game, right? So all of a sudden you can do randomization on the binary structure of the code that actually should run, relocating that code into other locations, right? Basically doing something like what address space layout randomization does without any hardware support in 32-bit address space, right? All by just shifting basic blocks around iteratively in a functionality preserving manner. And I'm gonna show you some algorithms for doing that. So here's, you know, graphically what that looks like, right? You take a piece of firmware and you look at its configuration. So if you don't have the HTTP server configured for your Cisco router, right, you figure out the code that corresponds to the HTTP server, right? And you remove it. And you end up with a piece of firmware that has a bunch of holes. And you take those holes and you split up the basic blocks of the code that you actually do need, right? And you relocate them over and over again, right? Each time you relocate the basic block, you're not changing the functionality of it all. You're just changing the binary structure of it, right? And basically what this means is you introduce a bunch of jumps, right, inside basic blocks. And you get a bunch of different functionally equivalent, binarily different variants of the same firmware, right? So imagine if an attack depended on knowing the specific address of, say, a specific function, right? This type of technique will prevent that attack from happening or from succeeding. So that totally works, and I'll show you a demo running on the Cisco 1871 router, right? The code for the HTTP server has been taken out. I'll show you that in a little bit, but let's look at the generalized algorithm for Autotomy. How do you figure out what code to take out, what code you can take out? Suppose, you know, this thing is the HTTP server, right? It has a function entry point that goes out, starts the server, calls a bunch of other helper functions, maybe some library functions and some other internal functions. So for example, it'll call printf, it'll call function A, B, and C, and then it'll call a library function, right? By recursively traversing this call graph, you can figure out what references each of these functions. You can see other functions outside of the server, right, server X, actually makes reference to printf and lib1, function 1. So in this case, you can't actually remove this code, because if you do, other pieces of code that has nothing to do with the server will break. But if you look, function A, B, and C are only referenced by pieces of code that's a part of the subcall graph, right, of the server. In this case, it's completely safe to remove this code entirely, right, if you disable the server and the server never starts. So you just do that. But first, you have to make sure that the function entry point returns something that won't crash the system, right? You basically do static analysis to figure out what the return code should be here, whether it's just a zero or error no code. And that, for the general case, is very difficult to do. It's intractable. But for specific cases like this, it's very easy, very predictable. Okay, and then once you do that, you can remove function A, B, and C, and all the data that refers to or is used by these functions exclusively. So you can take out the code and the data by doing this automatic recursive graph traversal. Okay? And then here's an example for, you know, this in the general case is really difficult to do, but in specific cases like Cisco IOS, there is enough structure in the operating system, in the way that this code is put together, that you can absolutely infer which piece of code starts from where and the call graph, et cetera. So for example, we can see that HTTP core, right, starts at a specific address. And you can go from there and apply the generalized Autotomy algorithm to figure out what pieces of code and data can be removed from there. Okay. And then binary structure randomization is basically taking a single basic block and then splitting it into two or more basic blocks and relocating them into different places without changing the functionality or the side effect of those basic blocks, right? Taking one basic block and moving it into two and adding a jump in between. So this is the very simplest one. It's a basic block split, right? This is the transform that preserves the functionality that just adds a single instruction. So all of a sudden you can take this basic block and you can move it anywhere you want. And then you can swap basic blocks, right? This is basically a compound transform that takes one basic block and then another basic block, break them in half, and then replace them together, provided that the two basic blocks are equal in size, right? And you can do this even when they're not equal in size. And here's a real-world example, right, of, you know, taking this binary structure and then adding some jumps and converting it to this binary structure, right? It's super late at night. I'm sure you guys are, you know, exactly what this is doing. You figure it out. But they look different, but they do the same thing, and that's really the point. So I'm going to do a demo now, and this demo comes from, it's running on a Cisco 1841 router running 12.4 iOS, and it is running without the web server or the SSH server. Can you guys see that? Okay, so I'm gonna enable. Okay, there we go. So now I'm enabled on the router. I'm gonna go and try to IP HTTP server go, right? So this is the configuration you have to put into the router to say, I want you to start the web server, right? Generally, if you're running, you know, backbone routers, core routers, you never want it to run the HTTP server, right? That's just asking for it. You really want the code out, and this one has no code that corresponds to the HTTP server anymore, and it gives you a very polite go away message that says, you don't want to do this, you can't do it, the code's not even there, don't even think about it, right? And nothing bad happened. The router booted up, it still routes, it still switches, it still does all sorts of things. So if you want to do show IP HTTP server status, you know, it would say, yes, you've configured it, but it's disabled, right? It's not working, right? The system continues to work, right? But the code has been removed. And all of a sudden, we can take the empty spots created by the HTTP server and start relocating basic blocks to make randomized instances of the same iOS firmware. Okay, so that works. Then I want to show you some. And we did this for a bunch of other services, you know, SSH, VRRP, Skinny, SIP, et cetera. And here's some preliminary quantitative data that we've collected about how much data and how much code you can actually remove from the various services inside iOS. The actual numbers aren't really important. What's important to observe here is that this is the amount of code that you can remove based on the steps of recursion. So like I said before, this is a recursive graph traversal algorithm. You start from the root, you figure out what you can remove at layer one, and then you keep on going recursively. So the deeper you look, the deeper you should be able to, the more code you should be able to remove. In every case we looked at, the data removal, right, basically stay the same, right, at these, at higher recursion levels. And that kind of makes sense because you put your debugging messages usually at the top of the call graph where you're about to start a server, right? You never put a debugging message inside something like malloc, for example, right? And this, you know, to me at least it makes sense that basically this is saying if you want to just remove data, you don't have to look very deep. But if you want to remove code, the deeper you go, the more code you'll get. At some point there is a diminishing return, right? So there's gonna be some mechanism that will tell you, okay, it's time to stop. And when you combine multiple features into one, you actually end up removing more code than those two pieces together separately, or those two pieces separately, right? Because you have an opportunity to remove code that is used both by HTTP and SSH, if that does exist, right? That you wouldn't otherwise be able to do if you just remove one or the other. So that's it, that's my talk. This stuff works, that demo worked. Questions? Do I have some time for questions? Or?
Yes.
All right. Questions?
Yes.
Comments?
Enough question time. We don't have any questions from the internet. Anybody else? Then come to the...
The stuff we did with rearranging blocks of code in firmware, would that be, I don't know if anyone's doing it, would that be just as applicable in normal binaries?
Oh yeah, absolutely. But so the question is, we're doing this in firmware, would it be applicable to, you know, general purpose applications inside general purpose computers? And it is, but there are other features inside general purpose computers like a 64-bit address space and address space layout randomization that essentially does some of this randomization that you wouldn't ever be able to get on this device right here, right? So if I had 64-bit address space and ASLR on this router, then the work that you have to go through to actually randomly relocate basic blocks and splitting them inside firmware, you can still use it, but it's probably less efficient. But this is designed specifically for legacy embedded devices.
Thanks. Any more questions?
So what is your, how do you deal with virtual methods or like with indirect jumps?
Yeah, so there are always corner cases, right? And the thing to point out about this type of technique is you don't actually have to remove every piece of code, and you don't actually have to remove or relocate the entirety of the code. You can keep the pointer where it is, right? Keep the first instruction to where that pointer is, and then remove the rest of the basic block, right? So if you have, you know, a jump that goes to another memory location that has a basic block, you can just take away, you can keep the first two instructions of that basic block and then move the rest of it.
Okay. Anything else? Well, then I thank you again, and I think
we have... Good time. Thank you.